Free Judiciary, proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to penal administration and to the rights of crime victims, sponsored by the House Judiciary Committee. And HDR 43 was heard in Judiciary and passed out with 4 do pass and 3 no recs. Originally, it did not have a finance referral, but when the elections added a fiscal note for the purpose of printing ballots, the finance referral was added. So that brings us to where we're at today. We have the prime sponsor, we have the chairman of House Judiciary with us today. I'm Representative Porter. And also online from Anchorage, we have Janice Lienhart. So I'd like to recognize at this time Representative Porter. Welcome to House Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will endeavor to give you a brief overview of the bill and would then ask, with your permission, that Janice be allowed to tell her perspective from the statewide organization of Victims for Justice, their perspective on the bill. For Janice's insight and for yours, if you have followed at all this bill, you will notice that the bill now includes only the section that would be added to the Constitution addressing victims' rights. If you remember the floor discussion we had on single subject on bills that would amend the Constitution, while there's differences of opinion on what is and isn't absolutely required under the general policy of it's better to be safe than sorry, we've divided these and you will be getting the other one, which deals with penal administration, albeit victims' rights also, but in perhaps another context, in a separate bill. So the bill that is in front of us, HJR 43, simply suggests the inclusion of a new section in our Constitution that would provide specific constitutional rights at a constitutional level to victims of crime. Victims of crime, of course, are not just those individuals who themselves are injured. It includes the families and spouses and relatives of people who are so injured. And to that end, allows their rights, which in the main, with a couple of exceptions, are already provided for in statute. It raises these, adds definition to a couple, raises all of them to the level of the Constitution, where for balance, you will find the individual rights of criminal defendants. I think all of us have been exposed to the ramifications of criminal defendants' rights being in the Constitution and the interpretations that have affected the criminal justice system based on criminal defendant rights being constitutional rights. What this bill suggests is that criminal victims should have at least a balanced set of rights as with criminal defendants, and that's what this would provide. As I say, I would be happy to answer questions now, or if with your permission, let Janice explain their position.
Okay, let's take a couple of questions now, and then we'll go to Janice. Representative Grusendorf, then Brian.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I find it kind of interesting because usually a constitution or constitutional law protects individuals from a government, all individuals, be they accused of something, and now we're talking about constitutional law that protects individuals from other individuals, which is normally statutory law. In other words, the Constitution has always been geared to protect people from the government, which they're concerned about abuses, and that's why we talk about due process and refer to substantial due process and all the things that you have to go through. But I find it rather peculiar that this approach is used. Is there any other state that uses has something like this? I know some constitutions, of course, have even how they run the trolley systems and things.
Representative Porter?
Through the chair, Representative Grusendorf. 14 other states have constitutional amendments now in place, and many others are in the state that we are in considering constitutional amendments for victims' rights. To specifically address your question about protecting individuals from the government, I agree, and that is, in the main, what these rights do. For example, it is the government that has control of a criminal defendant in the correctional system. And we're saying that a victim, for example, has the right to be informed by the government.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I follow your line of thinking. Yes, okay.
And there are several other of these kinds of examples that the government should provide this information or opportunity to a crime victim.
Okay, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am trying to understand the fiscal impact of the legislation, and I presume that there are no fiscal notes in our packet, or there is one small one from elections, but from the criminal justice agencies, because they are comparing the impacts relative to the status quo or current law, where these provisions are in current law.
That's correct.
And I guess the question that comes to my mind, Mr. Chairman, would relate to having to, when you say that someone has the right to be reasonably protected, and I see that that is part of current law, although, you know, what does that mean, and does the state incur a greater financial responsibility from putting in the Constitution some of these rights that are now part of the law? Because I just observe there are many things in the statutes that are not done for lack of appropriations or other priorities come along. So an agency, you often find they'll say, we just can't do everything, that we're not funded to do everything that's in the statute. And then if you put it here in the Constitution, I see at least three or four things in this list of rights that could have fiscal implications. The right to be reasonably protected, the right to timely disposition, which could be affected by how much appropriation there is for OPA and public defender, the right to be present at all of these times in the process, and whether we would then be obligated to fly people from wherever they are to wherever the hearing is occurring. Those are the questions I have as to what kind of new fiscal impact might be associated.
Response?
Through the chair, Representative Brown. Well, as you pointed out, these rights are provided now. The right, for example, of timely disposition that you mentioned, what exists now in law, as I'm sure most people are aware, is a right to a speedy trial for a criminal defendant. What happens, though, is that the speedy trial, which in this state has been interpreted to mean 120 days, can be waived, but only waived by the defendant. It can be extended by the defendant. And sometimes, for strategic trial reasons, the defendant will endeavor to expand that time. This isn't an additional cost that will accrue when the trial is going to occur. It's just when it is that it's going to occur. What I think would be a very interesting consideration by the Supreme Court is the right that we would be providing to the criminal victim to get on with business and have a speedy trial and get that case resumed. And what would the impact against the defendant's right to try to at least extend this time be, as opposed to the victim's right to have a timely trial? I cannot see that increasing costs. I can only see that doing what it is that the intent of this bill is, to balance the rights of criminal defendants and criminal victims.
Okay, let's take one more question, then we'll go to Janice Lienhart, and then we'll come back to questions after that. Representative Henley?
I was going to get on to one of my concerns was that the right to timely disposition of the case, and it actually sets up, which I don't have a problem with, although I wonder if it wouldn't work in the opposite effect, in that right now you have these timelines for the protection of the defendant. They can waive those beyond. I suppose the victim could do the same under a statute. Is that what you're saying? My concern is that if you have to have a timely disposition, there are some cases that may be dismissed because they're just, you know, within the time frames that are out there, you may actually, by requiring speedy disposition, work to the opposite effect of a disposition is dismissing the charges as well as going through with the trial. And I don't know if that had been thought through or if there's any likelihood of that. But
Mr. Chairman, Representative Henley, the right to a speedy trial, as we said, is an existing constitutional right of a criminal defendant, and that has been interpreted to mean 120 days. I would be astounded if the Supreme Court would interpret this right to mean a more rapid period of time than 120 days. So we stand now in jeopardy of losing a criminal prosecution if it is not brought within 120 days. This wouldn't change that.
Okay, let's move to Janice Meinhardt in Anchorage for her testimony. Then we'll come back to any questions that members of the committee may have, either Representative Porter or Janice Meinhardt. Janice, can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, the committee is ready for your testimony, Janice.
Thank you so much for allowing me to speak today. And I have called each of your offices encouraging you to support this constitutional amendment and give victims due process. I have spent about 7 years of my life working with victims as they've gone through the criminal justice system. And one of the most traumatic things they come across to realize that here I pay my taxes, I support the system, and the laws are made to protect the defendant, not me. And the defendant has constitutional rights. I don't. And we have statutes, but there's something about having a constitutional right that gives you due process. Our Constitution says we have the right to be protected for the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and some person took that away from us. And when that's taken away, and yet we don't have constitutional rights. And so, by having a constitutional amendment, it literally raises the victim up so that they will be considered in a higher level among the system because of the constitutional rights. And especially your people in the villages and in the bush and the native peoples who are really people that are very soft-spoken and often overwhelmed by the system. But again, with a constitutional right, it's more important. You're at higher level. Webb Shea, the past Attorney General, spoke, I believe, to the House on Capital Punishment. And his statement was, the most important thing we can do is make sure that victims have constitutional rights, equal rights, that we have due process. That's even more important than capital punishment because victims deserve it. It's part of being equal that will come into balance. The states that have passed the constitutional amendments are Arizona, California, Colorado, Florida, Illinois, Kansas, Michigan, Missouri, New Mexico, New Jersey, Washington, Rhode Island, Texas, and Wisconsin. All of these states have constitutional amendments that include victims. The states that are working on doing it this year are the Alaska, Georgia, Maryland, Maine, Massachusetts, Nebraska, Nevada, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, South Carolina. And the goal through the National Victims Group is that all victims have equal representation. All victims have constitutional rights. Victims for Justice is a statewide organization. We have over 3,000 members on our mailing list. And we send out newsletters. We keep our people informed. And we've encouraged them to call and to support this concept. And we will be doing a mail out. We will be letting them know how people are voting on these issues. It's probably, to me, one of the most important things we can do is support victims of violent crime. Somehow in our system, we get so out of balance, and now the pendulum is swinging back to balance. And it's time that victims should not have to always fight for constitutional rights. So I encourage you to support this. It definitely will make an incredible impact. It definitely will help balance the system. And it'll bring Alaska into other states that are coming into this. And before long, every state in the union will have constitutional amendments supporting this issue. Does anybody have any questions?
I have one general one, and Janice, it's going to sound stupid, I think. But my question is, what is the definition of a victim? And by that I mean, let me give an example. If someone hit me over the head and I was severely injured and had to spend a large amount of time or even became paralyzed, would a victim then be just myself, or would it be My spouse, or my children, or my grandmother, or father?
I believe that the legislator did define victims as being the person directly involved as well as the family members. But I thought I heard it. Is Representative Donnelly in there?
Yes, Senator Donnelly is.
I believe that it has been defined legislatively, and I can't say off the top of my head. I don't know if someone can help me with that.
Okay. I see a lot of heads nodding yes, so I'm sure we'll get the answer to it.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, there is a statutory definition of victim in Title 12, and it is quite a lengthy one, but it generally includes not just the individual who was victimized, but the family of that individual, right up to including a spousal relationship.
And I guess my follow-up question would generally be then, to what extent does the effort must be made to notify a victim? You know, in other words, victims have a habit of moving, years go by.
The statute that reflects the notification provision, I would have to read specifically, but I believe, number one, it requires that the victim notify the prosecutor, if it is the prosecutor that is handling the case at that point, that they wish to be notified, and then it requires that the prosecutor make reasonable attempts to do that.
Okay. Representative Parnell?
Representative Porter, if I could just explore a couple of the lines here. One, at line 11, a victim of crime shall be entitled to the right to restitution from the accused. Could you tell me what, under current law, what restitution an individual can seek from a perpetrator of a crime?
The law allows that in a criminal case where a conviction is rendered, that the court can, upon request, as part of the sentencing scheme, require restitution over a period of probation, during a period of probation, for example. There is a statute for victims' rights compensation currently that provides, under certain guidelines and procedural steps, compensation from the state to criminal victims. And obviously a criminal victim has the opportunity for normal civil action in civil court. We're not suggesting by this or any of the other specific rights that we have changed that. What we have done is raised it to a level of the same level of constitutional right that a criminal defendant has in his or her rights.
I agree with that concept. What I wanted to get at here too is you're envisioning both restitution within the criminal proceeding itself as well as a civil proceeding?
Yes.
Okay, and then if by the word accused, do you mean if convicted?
Well, I mean by whatever standard exists now. I think I see what you're referring to. I don't anticipate that this would change a standard that if a person has been accused of a crime that he or she is automatically responsible for restitution.
That's what I wanted to get on the record.
Yeah, that would not be the case. And whatever mechanism the victim chose to endeavor to receive restitution would dictate the level of proof required for that determination. If it were a criminal case where the victim was wanting the judge to, as a portion of sentencing, address restitution, obviously it would have to be a conviction. Otherwise, they would have to go through the civil court process with the same standards of preponderance of the evidence that exists there.
And then let's go to line 12, where it says they have the right to be informed of and present. There have been concern expressed earlier about, you know, what if a victim lives in New York and we have an Alaska hearing. Is it a fair statement to say that it's not your intent that the state will have to provide airline tickets to bring people back, but they have a right to be present, so they could be present telephonically, for instance, or through other means?
Fair question, and that is the interpretation that everyone that I have talked to about the bill has. This wouldn't provide any obligations to the state. It would provide the opportunity, which should not be denied.
Good. Thank you.
Okay, we had Representative Brown, Hanley, and Grusendorf then in that order.
Representative Parnell covered my question.
Okay, Representative Hanley.
He covered some of mine because right to be informed, of course, we've had problems with victims. And in fact, one of the Supreme Court cases, in Mr. Samuel's case, was one of the, and it was not a constitutional right at that point, it was a statutory right of the juvenile to have their parents informed. An attempt was made, message was left, the kid waived his rights, and it still went to the Supreme Court because of that. So that was a concern. And the reason I think everybody's getting this is the definitions, and we found in some other constitutional amendments, need to be at least clear on the record. The intent. I would add, is there a definition of proceeding? They have a right to be present at all criminal or juvenile proceedings. And the reason I ask that is what is a proceeding? And is a psychological, court-ordered psychological exam a proceeding?
No. A proceeding would be in an adult case, it's fairly clear that that is where the judge is present if it is a court case, or the jury is present if it is a jury case, or prior to the jury at motions in front of the judge. It would not include psychological evaluations or other things that might be ordered that would not be done in the court facility. Juvenile proceedings have different names and titles than adult proceedings, but basically it's the same approach, the same consideration that when the juvenile judge and or jury is in a position of making a determination on a motion or on guilt or innocence, the victim has a right to be there.
And I don't know if there's cases where the defense attorney and the defendant would go talk to the judge without the prosecution available. Is that a possibility? And if so, is that a case where the...
Would not. The judge would have to make a decision based on that conversation in open court, and that, of course, is the time when the victim has a right to be there.
Okay, Representative Grusendorf?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The preceding questions is bothering me, too. Present at all criminal and juvenile proceedings, that the person actually, by the Constitution, if this amendment was passed, would have the right to be there. Would it be possible that we may have circumstances where the person is notified of the court date or whatever the proceedings is going to occur, and that person says, no, it won't fit in with my schedule, and then we come in and find that there is a series of delays because that person has... who constitutionally now has a right to be there, is off doing, off doing something else, and the court system is sitting there, and they're all putting things off, and the parole officers, everybody is, and everything is because it's all hinged upon somebody saying that they may fly up from California, or they may, Mr. Chairman, I look at this and I see what they're trying to do, but we are talking about the Constitution. And normally when you have a constitutional amendment, you have a hue and cry out there by members of the public wanting a particular change in the Constitution. And oftentimes that's not necessarily good, because sometimes when majority of people are doing that, they put a minority at a disadvantage. But I notice that it seems to be the same individual when it was in judiciary, and we're talking about a constitutional amendment, had one person that testified. That same person that testified, the testimony was good, was the only one that testified here. Now, my question is, since I haven't heard about this in my district, I haven't received any other comments from anybody else, is this truly a problem? Thus, we must put it in our Constitution, because other states have it in their Constitution. And I would like to know the proceedings part there. Is the whole judicial system and administration now constitutionally completely hemmed in by the scheduling problems of an individual who says they might want to be there? say, sorry, we have a death in the family, but it's my constitutional, you know what I mean, my constitutional right. And I guess it comes back, as I haven't heard anybody talk about this before. If there were 20, 30, 50 people, not just in one place, but in Fairbanks, in Juneau and whatnot, saying that, you know, this is a problem, then I could say, well, yeah, I guess maybe it is. But it's the same person who's testifying. Her reasons are good.
Well, let me tell you, there are people there that care also, honestly.
Okay, Janice.
Janice, we're talking about the Constitution of the State of Alaska. And
as soon as Representative Grusendorf is done, Janice will recognize you for a response.
I said, you know, Mr. Chairman, that's my point, that there's a lot of very noble things we could put in the Constitution that people would be basically silent on, and I guess this makes, well, I don't know. But it bothers me when we're talking about statutes. You know, we've cluttered up the statute books enough, we can do that.
Okay, response, Janice?
I'm sorry.
No problem.
As far as when you were bringing out the point that would this prolong cases longer if the victim is considered in the continuances, well, guaranteed, they don't prolong cases. They want to get it over with. It breaks their heart every time they're put into a continuance. It's a killer on them. And just having a little opportunity to be considered, at least give them a little control in their life, is vitally important. Believe me, there are people from all over that support this, I can get some people from Fairbanks to call you if you want me to, because they're out there, and it is important, and they have me talk just because I guess I've been involved in it the longest, and I'm easier to reach, but I can certainly contact some of your constituents.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, on the point, what I'm saying is that if we are by the Constitution, required to inform all victims, but yet we can't get a hold of them, and the mail isn't forwarded because they've moved from this place to another place, I'm worried about the retroactivity or the person coming in and saying, my constitutional, you didn't inform me. My forwarding address was here or there, or so-and-so knew where I was, or it's a very interesting thing to scratch my head on. Thank you.
Representative Porter and then Martin.
Thank you. Through the chair, to in response to the concerns of Representative Grusendorf, a couple of times you asked the question, is this going to stop the criminal justice system because somebody had a bad hair day and wants the court to continue? In a word, no. The opportunity to be heard is an opportunity that would be allowed under the normal confines of the scheduling of the court. On the other hand, if a criminal victim could give rise to a consideration for the court that the defendant has intentionally positioned a schedule to disallow that victim's appearance, that would be a right that would be looked at to be balanced by the court. But in terms of a victim being able to take advantage of one of these provisions to be totally self-serving and disregard the costs to the system and all those kinds of things, this wouldn't be the intent, and I'm sure would not be the interpretation of the court.
Okay, Representative Martin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to bring to the attention of Representative Grusendorf that this is not the first attempt in the state legislature. I remember as early as 1987, constitutional amendment being brought up. And so it's a issue that's been lingering for at least 7, if not 10 years. Then also, and I guess I asked Mr. Parnell, isn't there all kinds of acceptance as to what is a fair opportunity or an attempt to notify someone in many different laws, like your notice of evictions, notice of past due debts, notice of court hearings, and things like that, where as long as there's an honest attempt, then that is justified by the courts?
if there's a reasonable offense.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, I'm reminded that the current statute, which would not be altered, provides that the witness who is asking to be notified must provide current address. And obviously, if that current address changed without notification to the prosecutor or whomever, then that fulfills the obligation. I would mention, too, that we had a joint judiciary committee hearing on this bill with the Senate, and there was an abundance of testimony during the interim.
Okay, do we have any other questions, Representative Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple questions, then I have some suggested changes to the language, but...
Let me interrupt this one second. Do we have anyone else in the audience who wanted to be heard on this bill? Okay, do you want to proceed with your questions now, or do you want to hear more testimony?
I'll go ahead with the question then. My question is, are we establishing a greater level of responsibility on the state with the provision of these items in the Constitution by putting these items here more than we have in current law? And the one that I'm thinking about is the right to be reasonably protected. And if, for example, a violent crime occurred in a village where we don't even have village public safety officers or troopers or any organized police force, how is that interpreted in reality, or how is that applied? How is the current law accomplished in reality when it seems like that you can think of situations where people are not going to feel that they're being reasonably protected, and there may not be anybody around to protect them, and then even in urban areas that it's very difficult to assure that people are being reasonably protected, particularly during the period pending trial.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, I think it, by definition, that is why the term reasonable was put in the statute originally. This is, to answer your first question, this does not raise the responsibility over the statutory requirement that we have now. And the statutory requirement does say reasonable. It doesn't say guarantee. It doesn't say to any extent possible. It says reasonably protect. And from my interpretation, at least, and what I understand of the interpretation of the statute in the past, it really just kind of reinforces some of the other rights in terms of notification.
As a follow-up, would there be any additional liability upon the state, this being in the Constitution, than what it is in statute?
There certainly is none that I see written, and no intent to increase the liability.
Representative Brown?
Thank you. Following up on the point that Representative Parnell raised about the restitution at line 11, it seems like that it would be good to specify that we're talking about after conviction, and that we should move that phrase down to line 14, because you're getting it out of sequence. If you look at the sequence that's being followed in the enumeration of rights, the restitution comes after the trial, and I think that would be an improvement. That's one suggestion I have. Another suggestion I have would be on these rights to be present, that we might say, and to have the opportunity to be present, to have the opportunity to be heard upon request. And, you know, what I'm thinking there is to, what we want to say is the system is going to go. You have an opportunity to come. It doesn't mean that you have a right to be there at our expense or, you know, whatever the situation might be, and that that might be a clarification that would be worthwhile to make. So I'd invite the sponsor's comments on that, or Senator Donnelly.
The transference of the term restitution from the accused down to where it would fit more sequentially, I wouldn't have any opposition to. I wouldn't want that misinterpreted to mean that a criminal victim didn't have the opportunity, whether there was or wasn't a conviction, to seek civil remedy, which of course is a different standard of proof. But with that qualification, I would have no objection to moving from line 11 to line 14, or whatever that turns out to be.
So, if I could...
I may, just for procedure purposes, we brought up committee substitute for House Joint Resolution 43, Judiciary, and what we're referring to now is a proposed committee substitute.
Correct.
So maybe if we could have a motion to get the vehicle before us, then we can direct our attention to it. Representative Henley?
Well, I move that we adopt this as the committee substitute for the working draft.
Okay. Is there any objections to that? Any objections? Hearing none, then, what is formally before us then would be the proposed committee substitute for House Joint Resolution number 43, which will be the Finance Committee substitute then. Representative Brown?
Thank you. And then, did I hear you correctly, Representative Porter, that you would not want to stick in or change the term the accused to something implying someone who's convicted? If we said to restitution from the accused after conviction, because then that might diminish their right to seek civil remedies even if they weren't convicted. But I mean, how can we put into the Constitution something that says just because I accuse you of a crime, you have the obligation to make restitution to me? That just doesn't seem right.
Well, that isn't what it says. What I said was I would not mind taking the phrase from line 11 and putting it in line 14, as you suggested, to make it sequentially for conviction.
I guess my other suggestion was to add the words after conviction following the accused to restitution from the accused after conviction. Or some other phrase that would show that the person had been convicted.
Have the courts ever ordered restitution before conviction?
Not in this state.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond to that, no, they have not. And when we're dealing with a criminally accused person, restitution cannot be ordered prior to conviction. What I don't want to confuse is the victim's right to go civilly after an accused person, whether they were ever charged with a crime.
Mr. Chairman, it does say...
Representative Navarre?
It does say rights of crime victims in the constitutional amendment. And I think that if we make the record very clear, we can exclude the civil restitution process from this constitutional amendment. And I stress making sure that we make the record clear. As we've seen in the past, we have several constitutional amendments now that don't appear to work, including the spending limit, the budget reserve.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to that end, and that's a valid point, but a person can certainly be a crime victim, and there never be a person convicted of that crime. So to tie any rights to conviction, I think, is inappropriate.
Representative Navarre?
But on the other hand, Representative Brown's comment about the right to restitution from the accused, right. If the accused is completely exonerated and...
there's no crime.
Mr. Chairman, an accused in a criminal trial is never completely exonerated. There's one of two verdicts, well, three, dismissed, which means nothing, guilty or not guilty. Doesn't say proven innocent. You know,
right.
I get that.
Right, but if I'm accused and all of a sudden the evidence looks like it's me and all of a sudden you find out Mr. Rusendorf did it, I'm pretty much exonerated, right? I mean, you drop the charges against me. You might not say I'm innocent, but you go convict him. I mean, that's pretty good.
Let me make a suggestion. What if we just said to restitution,
yep,
and then leave out the words from the accused?
Mr. Chairman, on that, I don't mean the state.
Representative Henley?
Yeah, and that was the concern that if it, that takes care of that problem, but then is it the state's responsibility,
yes,
to provide restitution at that point? If it's not from the accused, you could interpret it that they are entitled to restitution. Let's say the person is destitute and actually they're entitled to it, but they can't get any money out of them. Then is it the state's responsibility to provide that restitution?
Okay. Representative Brown?
How about from the perpetrator of the crime?
The accused.
No, accused, there's too much opportunity for, I mean, false accusation. Just because you're accused does not mean anything. Yeah. I mean, I don't think that ought to give the other person some constitutional right to come against you because they've accused you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Henley?
I think there's two things here. One is a victim of a crime and is entitled to restitution from the accused. You can't be a victim of a crime. I mean, for restitution, if the person is not convicted, either in civil court that, where they can get restitution, or in criminal court, they can't get restitution. Is that not correct? So if they are not convicted of a crime in a criminal court, I doubt they cannot get through that criminal court restitution because they're not a victim of a criminal crime. If they go to civil court and they are not awarded or it proves that that person is not convicted, I would suggest that they're not going to be able to get restitution there either. I mean, if someplace you have to prove they're a victim of a crime.
Well,
so if at some place or another, whether it's in civil court or criminal court, there has to be proven a victim of a crime. And just so that alone, because I couldn't go out right now and say you did something to me, and say I'm entitled to restitution. Somebody has to prove that I am entitled to restitution. It's either criminal or civil, and I don't see necessarily the problem. It doesn't read necessarily correctly. But.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, to this end, well, I'm certainly not a proponent of let's do it just because that's the way they do it outside. This wording is taken from existing state statutes outside.
Is Senator Donnelly, do you wish to make a comment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Martin was right. You know, he talked about the history behind this.
Could we have you pull up your chair so we can testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dave Donnelly. The reason that I didn't sponsor a constitutional amendment on this subject prior to the beginning of this legislature, which in 1993, was I felt it was important to get some things on the statutes that set out the rights of victims first. And that's what we accomplished since 1987. We had two major acts and additional laws also that created a body of law interpreting, giving victims certain rights and setting out how they would be administered under statute. I believe that the way to kind of cut through this knot here of trying to address in the Constitution specifically the intricacies of this is to provide that these new constitutional rights may be established by law or shall be provided by law. In other words, giving the legislature the right to establish by law the interpretation of these rights. There's other areas of the Constitution, frankly, I wouldn't necessarily support that. It might be going too far. But in a new area like this, I think that is appropriate. And also it's appropriate at this time since we have this body of statutory law developed that's there. And by doing so, we know if we put that kind of caveat in to this, we know that this is what we've got now and that's what we're going to get by this, and it won't be more or less than that because we have provided for that by law at this time. That's one way to avoid this problem of what does this all mean in the future. And I know Representative Parnell, as a fellow lawyer, knows that there's no guarantees as to how a court will interpret this without that caveat of deferring to the legislature that authority to interpret it through statute. That's one way to avoid this big problem, and that's the position I've been supporting. It's not. First of all, the rights of the accused in the process are not totally a protection only against the state action. If you think about how the criminal process works, the criminal accused has rights that extend beyond that because it's within the criminal justice process. Those rights are there. And if you think further about the way we work the civil justice process, the state isn't even a party in that process unless it's directly impacted. It's the state determining the rights of people within the civil justice process, which are set out in the Constitution also, between two independent parties. So this relatively new legal concept of bringing the victim into that mix, if you really think it out, it's not such an abrogation to what we're used to. It's just something we're going to have to adjust to and keep an open mind with. And it clearly isn't the classical way of thinking about the criminal justice process, but it's not as bizarre as it might first appear at first blush if you think about how the role of the Constitution affects people's rights throughout the court process. And it is a very strong national movement. There are, in fact, federal constitutional amendments before the United States Congress at this time, and it was the strong recommendation of the major work that was done under, I think it goes all the way back to possibly, I know it was, in, I think it was the Reagan administration did some major work looking at our criminal justice system, and was one of the recommendations of some of their very, very long work that was put in on some of the national task force back then, that there be a federal constitutional amendment also. And there has been this national movement for state constitutional amendments. So it has a very broad grassroots support. And one thing you got to remember when you're dealing with victims' rights and these type of things, people don't have a direct pecuniary interest in these kind of things. It's not the kind of thing that you hire lobbyists and send down to Juneau and they're there talking with us, because these aren't people that have the money to do that. In fact, the person these things are really going to help is somebody that doesn't even realize it at this time. They haven't been put in the victim situation yet. And it's really a volunteerism by the people who have experienced this, been through this process, found it to be unfair to the people who innocently were placed in these positions that come forward and work on these issues. It's not because they're going to gain some benefit from it themselves even. And that makes it a little less likely you're going to see, you know, the huge amount of outpouring you have when it's a direct day-to-day impact on their daily livelihood type thing, or something else that's more direct to them. But there has been a wonderful volunteer movement with this, of people who really dedicated themselves because of their personal experience in this area, and not because they have those typical financial interests that you usually really see these giant movements come forward for. And there's exceptions to that, of course, we all know them. But this is a real classic one where people are doing this because they really believe it's the right thing to do, more for people in the future, not even themselves. Because most of the people who are doing it have been victimized in the past, and this isn't going to benefit them very much. They've already been through the process. I do think that some of the ideas that came forward in the House regarding the structuring of Section 12 of the Constitution still have a lot of merit. And in the process going on our side, we're continuing to maintain those in the body of the proposals we have before us. And that's setting out the priorities for the administration of the penal justice system. And I have provided the committee with copies of the most recent legislation that's passing through the committee side on our side, just for your reference. The chairman of the judiciary in the Senate has expressed his opinion and just my personal opinion. Although it isn't a classic drafting technique that you would find in the Alaska Constitution, when we're dealing with an amendment that enumerates so many specific rights, that the two of us felt, and the prior committees have felt, that it was appropriate to list those out. So you see a different drafting format. It's strictly a drafting preference. It's mox nix, I think, other than just to make it simpler to deal with. But what you will find that's different is at the end of that list is a very clear provision that the legislature may provide by law for enforcement. And that got us out of all the intricate details and all the complex questions that you've been trying to deal with today by saying that makes our body of law that deals with victims, that codifies it and makes it not in conflict in any way with the Constitution now. because we've incorporated it then. So we don't anticipate any future conflicts between what this language interpretation of what this language means versus existing statutory law. So we know we've got that to work with. And then let's think about what additional things this may deal with. Well, it may raise additional questions. And as those questions are articulated, this type of empowerment specifically gives the legislature the authority to deal with them as those questions may arise. They may not arise, but if they do, it would allow us as a body to work together to solve those. And there's, on our side, there's been some concerns raised by the Department of Law that I think we're dealing with this. And is there anybody from the Department of Law here today that I wanted to address too, if they were going to bring those up today? But with that, I really appreciate the opportunity to address the committee.
Here we have Representative Martin, Grusendorf, and Brown. Representative Porter.
Thank you very much, and to Donnie, for your testimony. In this one sentence on line 11, referring to restitution, could we say to restitution from the person found guilty? Would that solve some of the problems rather than just one accused?
Yep.
Would that
be the chair? Certainly, you could say that. Representative Parnell raised this question about restitution earlier.
Yeah.
Classically, in criminal law, restitution doesn't fit. I mean, criminal law is the state versus the accused.
Mm-hmm.
Restitution is a concept that's rather recent in development, where the criminal courts would actually make some sort of civil adjustment that would classically be a realm of the civil court. The court system isn't a big fan of restitution because it kind of muddies the water, but it certainly has been a success in the way it's developed, in that restitution is only given for those kind of damages that are very simple to prove. In other words, it's very obvious if somebody's found guilty of a robbery that the subject of the robbery, the items that were stolen that weren't returned, clearly are damages. So that it's very simple to prove. I own this, it's gone, they were convicted of stealing it, that's a damage. It's real easy to prove. There's a lot of other types of damages that are very complex to prove. And those are the type of things that the criminal courts have not wanted to get into, and that's where the gray areas really start to get difficult. What is the proper role of the criminal courts in that form? How far should they go? And I think you can fine-tune it that way, Representative Martin, but the real issue at that time becomes, what have we done to that balance that's been struck between the civil and the criminal justice system? And what will a court later say if you don't defer to some sort of statutory guidelines on that subject?
Well, Mr. Chairman, on this point here, I don't think it's a new thing we're getting into. I think it's a good old thing that we've gotten out of, like the biblical days, we don't want an eye for an eye. But the common law of England pursued that, and of course colonial days did too, where when you burn a person's home down and you were able to do it, you built that home back up. Where you damage someone, you may have insurance for your family, but that person may be paralyzed. You may be able to help them for the rest of their life by some kind of financial help and their well-being. So I'd like to get back to the original intent. One of the major reasons that you make a person whole from a crime is that they would be compensated somehow. Not the state, but the individual who's been victimized. Mr. Parnell.
Yeah, I'm going to vary just a little here, but I do want to hear from Representative Porter on two points. Once again, in regards to the restitution, and number two, Senator Donnelly's suggestion about for the legislature to provide by law for the enforcement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you'll notice throughout the text of Section 24, as we have it here in HJR 43, the term for the defendant is the accused throughout.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why it's there for restitution from the accused. We certainly want to make it clear that it's restitution from an individual responsible for the damage as opposed to the state. And that's why that's there. And I really don't see a problem with considering that this is going to somehow translate to a responsibility to someone who's not been convicted where otherwise they would have been, or those things. To the implementation by law, the discussion on our side was a concern, one that this may, and I would address it to Senator Donnelly for his input, a concern that would this inclusion, one, require then that any right that was listed in the constitutional provision have to be in statute before it was implemented to become a right? And what would happen then if, and in terms of protecting, as Representative Grusendorf said, an individual from the government, there are some agencies in government that are going to have to do some things, and this is reinforcing that they're going to have to do some things. Prosecution, for example, will fall heir to a couple of duties, as they are right now. But what if, for some reason, a very influential attorney general decided he was trying to mitigate the activities of his office and somehow convinced the legislature to drop that individual statute, which can be done with 21 votes and 11 votes? Mm-hmm. What does that do to that right as listed in the Constitution? And I'd be happy for
through the chair.
All right, Senator Donnelly.
Fortunately, we have an example in constitutional law in our state directly on point to that question. It's an important question, and that's the constitutional right of privacy. When that was added to our Constitution, if y'all got copies around, there's a provision in that that specifically says it shall be implemented by the legislature. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I can't think of a single instance where the legislature's ever done anything, ever passed a single statute that dealt with it. There might be something out there, but basically it was never done. And yet the court went ahead and said...
Well, they sure did.
Yeah, that's a right of the people of this state, the right to privacy, even though the legislature never specifically implemented it. And I think that's a real good guidance of what would occur here. These would become your basic rights as interpreted, well, my position was hopefully as interpreted by statute, but if it wasn't addressed by the legislature, clearly the court would, as they did with the right to privacy, and I guess I should never say clearly dealing with our court, I'm sorry, but from past experience, the court should, if they're consistent, say that these are basic rights. Even though the legislature hasn't specifically provided, other than our body of victims' rights law, if there's something in here that isn't already provided for, that's a right too. And they may interpret it by statute, but if they hadn't, it's still a right, and we're going to enforce it as such.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would certainly defer to the experience of the multitude of years in this and your committee and Senator Donnelly to address the concern that we had regarding whether that should or should not be included. If it is the considered opinion of this group that it should be, I certainly would not oppose it.
Okay, we have Representative Grusendorf, then Brown and Parnell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. At least Senator Donnelly, you and Representative Portia did bring up societal norms in your discussion, which would have been a nightmare to define under the other version of this. You know, and I don't want to lose sight, Mr. Chairman, of the restitution,
comes up, yes.
Restitution of the accused. I don't want to lose sight of this in my discussion here. But in looking at this, it's obvious that when you're really talking fiscal notes, we're really talking more than just the cost of the election here. We're talking about probably the prosecutor, parole and probation officers having in their file the names, addresses, numbers of these people, thus constitutionally having the responsibility to inform the victim of whatever proceedings they're going to do. So we are talking about the government assuming a certain responsibility to inform along the stages of processing, which of course is going to take time, and time, I know, always costs money when it comes to government. So I don't want to lose sight of the fact it's just the cost of the election. It will not be. But let's say, for example, the Superior Court of the State of Alaska sentences an individual. Somehow, the victim, due to circumstances of where they were in the world, not only in the state, but in the other in the United States, wandering around the place, comes back with a constitutional question challenging this. It goes to the Supreme Court, the state of Alaska, and they say, yes, indeed, this person was not informed. But we're caught in a very unique situation. We can't go try the person again because it would be double jeopardy, even though the victim claims that the sentence that was given was not, you know, what it should be. You can't go back and do a double jeopardy thing. But yet the person under the Constitution of the State of Alaska is indeed protected by the said, yes, he should have been there. I just see a kind of an administrative nightmare that... And I'm not against this, please. I'm just trying to figure out how it would work. And I also have the same fears that Representative Parnell has with the restitution from the accused. And Brown has brought out the question of the location of it. Or does a restitution actually would reflect back upon the state in some of these other proceedings here? And so maybe it should be moved not to line 14, but maybe even in between 15 and 16, talking about that this doesn't mean that the person does not have a right in civil suits to pursue restitution.
Thank you, Representative Brown.
Thank you. If I might direct a question to, I expect Senator Donnelly probably knows the most about this, but I was trying to look at the statutory citations and understand existing provisions in existing law with respect to your right to be present and your right to be heard. And so my question would be, because I'm not finding them all, such as 1261.101. I don't know if that's a typo, but it's not in the... I can't find any such statutory reference either in the main body or in the supplement. So my question would be, if this passes, if this constitutional amendment were to pass, what would be changed about current law, if anything?
Senator Donnelly?
Well, it depends on what version you pass.
Work draft for HJR 43.
You see... And Representative Parnell, I want you to help me out here because you're the other lawyer here, right? Frankly, I can't tell you all the things that the court would say would change in existing statutory law just the way this is written now because it doesn't defer to statute. So any time the court felt that the voters of the state, frankly, that's the real key, is what the voters intend, I think, on constitutional amendments, because we put it before them, but they ratify. And the courts should really look to what the voters' intent was when they ratified things, because they're the final word on a constitutional amendment, as opposed to what we intend when we do a statutory thing. So without some sort of deferral to the legislature's authority to write legislation, I think it's really hard to project what a court might say here, in their opinion, might conflict with existing statutory law or any vacuum in law.
Mr. Chairman, on that, I think, and Senator Donnelly, I think you're right. I think the courts would look first to the statute. You only fall back on the Constitution if they've already gone through the other layers. And so the Constitution would have precedence over statutes, but to the extent that the statutes are consistent with the Constitution, I think the court would look at the statutes first. Could you clarify? I mean,
the specific case I was thinking of was the juvenile proceedings, and that's why I was looking in the statute to see whether, under current law, juvenile proceedings are expressly open to victims. Are all stages of juvenile proceedings open to victims? And you're shaking your head, no.
No. Well, there are some just very recent developments. The last law opened proceedings up to a limited scope of victims. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Would this amendment conceivably further open up juvenile proceedings? Well, if you have the right to be, you know, these things aren't qualified. It just says you have the right to be present. And I'm...
Well, through the chair, we've been dealing with this problem on our side too. There's several things to affect. First of all, we got to realize that there's some federal constitutional baseline protections for juveniles that that adults don't have. There's a body of federal constitutional law on the subject to juveniles. So we can never remove that base, whatever it may be, by simply amending our state constitution. So you've got that dynamic in place here. Second, classic juvenile proceedings, in other words, your classic juvenile justice proceedings are not considered criminal proceedings. So there's a split there. And we wrestled with that on our side, and that's why you see the language in the version that I passed out to you. That's an attempt to deal with this split. And as you notice, as you go through the list of the rights as we enumerated, some of them referred both to the criminal and juvenile justice process, and some of them don't, because some of those particular rights don't necessarily apply appropriately to the juvenile justice process, because they're considered separate. And one more thing I want to just lay on the table, just that we discovered in ARB, which I found interesting. Even as a lawyer, I never really had thought about it that way. But the provisions, why you classically don't think of penal as because the constitutional section deals with the principle of penal administration, classically you think of that as prisons and corrections. But in law, the word penal applies to punishment. So it actually is encompassing of all systems that involve some sort of punishment. Would be the argument that could be made. Who knows exactly what it means? But under law, penal, the word penal means punishment. So it's not just a prison. It's dealing with all the scope of punishments that could be appropriate out. And so that's why we decided to try to say something more precisely than that, because the average person really couldn't understand that, we thought. So there's a few other dynamics we've encountered in working with this area. I'm sorry if I'm not answering real specifically, but I don't think you can answer specifically unless... The thing that will give you some consistency is say that what's in place now is good, right? And then you say none of that changes, right?
Ms. Chairman.
Senator Brown.
Thank you. I liked Senator Johnley's suggestion of saying the legislature shall define this, because I think that does clear up a lot of questions. And then I guess what I was going on with is I read 1261.010, you're talking about the right to appear at the sentencing. Okay, well, this seems, what's in here now, and especially as it applies to juveniles, I'm speaking of the, if we were to add the legislative interpretation sentence to the proposed work draft, and then we would have the right to be the right to be informed of and present at all criminal or juvenile justice proceedings where the accused has the right to be present. And I guess it's my, I'm asking, does that expand? It appears to me to expand what's currently provided in law. And if so, wouldn't the Constitution in that case override, you wouldn't just be able to reference the existing statutes because they're inconsistent. I mean, here you'd have an express provision saying that you could be there at all stages of the juvenile justice process. I don't believe our statute currently provides for that, or at least we can't seem to come up with the citation of it where it does provide that. So that's one question, and then I'd like to get into grand juries and how those are effective.
Okay, let's just give them a minute here to...
Hey, Mr. Chairman. Sure. I made some comments earlier that I wanted, after hearing further discussion, I wanted to clarify for Representative Brown kind of where I'm coming from now as to restitution from the accused. I tend to agree with Representative Porter and Representative Hanley that I don't have a problem with moving that language, but I am concerned about limiting the victim's rights in a civil proceeding by making this only a person who is convicted. And my sense is that the court, based on what was said here earlier, the court is going to continue ruling in the same way it has in the past, and this would not open up a Pandora's box, so to speak, for people who are merely accused and not convicted. And similarly, if you change the language to restitution from the perpetrator, you may similarly limit a civil proceeding with that kind of language, because there may be four people involved in a crime, all of whom damaged you in some way, and you want, I mean, who's the perpetrator, and how would that affect or impact a civil proceeding for restitution?
Wouldn't they all be?
I think you can sue them. You can sue them all civilly. I think you're right there, but I really get concerned about trying to do something good and having an impact down the road on a civil proceeding and limiting that unintentionally. And so, unless we had a legal opinion, I wouldn't want to be changing this at this point with language that's already consistent throughout this particular provision. So at this point, I wouldn't want to be changing to restitution from the accused without some sense that it's not going to limit other rights downstream under a civil proceeding.
Further discussion?
Can they answer the question about the juvenile?
Juvenile? As you can see, that there's three statutory references. I've looked at 33, and that appears to be totally with adults. I can already 12 here. The problem is that this is recent legislation. You have to look in the statute, then in the supplement. And it's got two.
Senator Foster and I didn't have any concerns until we had two attorneys agree, and then we got
concerned. I was all for this.
These are the adult things, but somewhere else it sets out. Representative Brown, we're just going to have to take a look at specifically the provisions, because my recollection is that we did extend some access to juvenile, very limited. My memory was very limited access to juvenile proceedings. It wasn't as encompassing as with adult. But I'd really need to look at the law again to define that. And it's going to be in a separate area that we're really not as familiar working with.
The question to then the sponsor, Representative Porter, is: is it your intention to change existing law with the language here in this?
I can't. As is always the case when you're looking for something, I can't find a specific reference, but I have read it. There is now a provision that allows criminal victims to be present at certain proceedings of juvenile hearings. This amendment is not designed to enhance that. It is just, as we stated, designed to take existing statutory rights and raise them to a constitutional level.
Could I ask then about how grand juries are affected?
Grand juries now have the only people allowed to be present in a grand jury is the prosecutor, a witness called by the prosecutor, and the grand jury members themselves. This would not change.
What about if the accused is subpoenaed to appear at a grand jury?
Then they have the same requirements as any other subpoenaed witness.
And then would that open up the right of victims to come to a grand jury?
The accused does not have an individual right to come to a grand jury. The accused has no right to appear at a grand jury.
No.
Anybody who is subpoenaed has a right to come to a grand jury. So I see what you mean, but no.
How often? I think it's very seldom. It's a very, very rare case where an accused is subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury, because they have the right of non-self-incrimination. They don't have to answer any questions to a grand jury.
It has occurred,
yeah,
certainly, but only because of their subpoena. Were they allowed to be there?
Okay, let me see if I can direct our attention to find out just exactly where we're at here in committee. I think we've had three concerns that have been brought up. One in regards to restitution. And do we have any further discussion or suggestions of what we should do in regards to that? Does someone care to make a motion?
Mr. Chairman, do you want that motion? A person found guilty? Would that be better than accused?
Mr. Chairman?
No, I'm asking there if the committee wishes to do anything. That was a concern
brought
up. I'll
leave it up to the two lawyers.
Representative Parnell?
Well, before we start changing the language, I think we're all pretty much in agreement on the fact that it could be moved. And perhaps I would move that we delete the language from line 11 that says to restitution from the accused, mm-hmm. comma, and move that to line 14 after the word considered, comma.
Okay, we have a motion before us. Does everyone understand the motion? Are there any objections to the motion? Hearing no objections, then, so ordered. Then we had concerns expressed, I think, from Senator Donnelly to the language where it said, or the legislature may provide by law for the enforcement of this section. Does the committee wish to do anything in regards to that concern? And if the committee wishes, would someone make a motion?
Sorry.
I'll move that we adopt the subsection B, which states the legislature may provide by law for the enforcement of this section. And you can see the language in the Senate resolution to state affairs.
Representative Henley?
I've got a brief question on that. I don't necessarily have a problem with it. We're not working off this, but there's a difference. The enforcement of a section is different, at least in this resolution, than shall have the following rights as provided by law. And I don't know what you're trying to get at. If you look at this, it says on page 1, it says crime victims as defined by law, number 1, shall have the following rights as provided by law. And then it says the legislature shall enforce this by law. So there's, I don't know which one you're trying to get at.
What language is used under the privacy? I mean, is it implement? The legislature shall implement this section?
I think
section,
it's implement.
Implement by law. Just like your constitutional amendment.
That may actually be broader. That would cover both definitions of rights and definition of enforcement.
Where's your
but I see the difference. I think
there's
a difference
out
between the two.
Defined by law, shall have the following rights as provided by law. See, we've really deferred to the statutory process. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanley raises an excellent point. Ours has two. It's in both places, the caveat that you defer to the legislature, the statutory law.
Yeah.
In implementing the rights. Yeah.
In other words, I guess the question that has been brought up then is that already covered, and do we need that new language or not? Any response, Representative Brown?
I think I'll defer to the sponsor.
If it's the committee's wish, and I would not object to including this kind of language, I can suggest a place to put it.
Okay, when you make that suggestion, then we'll see what the response is.
If on line 7 we interjected the language from the beginning of the Senate's version of section 24, in other words, it would say, beginning on line 6, to preserve and protect victims' rights to justice and due process, comma, then we would insert crime victims, as defined by law, shall have the following rights as provided by law. Hmm. Including, and we'll drop, the crime victim shall have the, start right out, right to be reasonably protected, and go on.
Okay, let me ask if, Carol, were you able to get that suggested language?
I didn't get all of it.
No.
Sir.
Okay, Luann did not get all of it, so.
It's the same as the Senate.
Before we etch it in stone, maybe if there's a suggestion.
At the beginning.
Because they don't provide by law. That's what we're doing now with Section 17.
The place never did anything.
Okay, we're kind of breaking down here. We got a lot of conversations going.
Cornell has a suggestion. Just pair up the language.
Representative Martin?
Mr. Chairman, the problem I have with that is that the problem we have with Section 17 of Article 9 now, and the constitutional amendment, the last sentence says, as provided, as implemented by law by the legislature. We haven't done anything. And so that's where part of our problem is. We haven't implemented the payback provision of that constitutional budget reserve. So what about if the legislators don't do anything, just like Senator Donnelly set up the right to privacy? The legislators have failed to do anything, so the courts are doing it all.
I think, Mr. Chairman, if I can respond to that, in this case, as opposed to the other, there are
laws already,
statutory
there are
provisions in place.
Four cases, yeah.
We're just acknowledging that they are there, that we're not trying to change them, and interpretation of this of these rights will be made by statute. If Representative Parnell's got a better way of
planning
that in, that's fine.
It's going to take some work.
Representative Parnell.
Under our Constitution as it stands now, for instance, Article 1, Section 3, under civil rights, no person is to be denied the enjoyment of any civil or political right because of race, color, creed, etc., period. The legislature shall implement this section, period. And if it's the will of the body, I would just move that at line 15, right after the word custody, period, that we insert the words, the legislature shall implement this section, period.
I'll withdraw my earlier motion.
Okay, let's recognize Representative Brown. Is there any objections to Representative Brown withdrawing her earlier motion? Hearing none, then so ordered. Representative Parnell, would you make a motion then?
Sure. I would move that at line 15, after the word custody, period, that we insert the words, the legislature shall implement this section, period.
Okay, does everyone understand the motion? Luann, were you able to get the motion?
Yes, sir.
Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, then so ordered. The third thing I've heard discussed today is in regards to the juvenile proceedings and the rights that the victims have in attending those. Does the committee wish any further action in regards to the discussion we had there? If so, would someone make a motion? Representative Brown?
I think we're still, or I am, lacking in an understanding of what the current law provides and how this would change it. So it's hard to make a motion on that. I just say I'd like to know how current law would be changed by this before we not necessarily move it out of here, but before we vote on it on the floor. I do have one other for language.
Representative Porter had a comment he wished
I think,
to make.
I apologize for not being able to lay my hand on that statute, but Senator Donnelly and I both read it, and it provides access to some juvenile proceedings, I'm sure, if not all, by criminal victims now. Whatever it says, I think especially by the additional language that we've just added of the legislature shall implement, that we're not intending to expand that statutory provision.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brown.
That may not be your intent or the intention to expand it, but it does say all juvenile proceedings where the accused has the right. I mean, I'm just concerned about if there is a conflict between current law and this, what are we changing with this? Because I think if current law is, and I believe you're right, there is some limited right of access now. So I'm just pointing out that this will have other ramifications, and I'd like to know and understand what those are. And if that's not our intent to expand it, then maybe we do need to tweak this language some more to do that, because it seems very broad the way that it's written.
Any further discussion on that point or any others? Representative Parnell.
I'd like to hear from Representative Brown what she thinks the danger of expanding it would be if it is indeed an expansion. I don't know what...
Well, if... I don't, you know, I haven't thought a lot about it. The current law was considered when limit, you know, if it's, we're operating on a lot of premises here, but if, as the sponsor states, there is a limited right, at the time that statute was put in place, presumably they had a debate about what was appropriate, and there were reasons for why not just make them all open to everybody. And, you know, I don't know, I just would like to understand more about what we're changing and what the ramifications are. I'm not sure. But I had another point.
Okay, let's go to the next point.
I'd like to see if the sponsor would agree to insert, to have the opportunity to be inserted before the word present on line 12, and also have an opportunity to be inserted after the second two on line 13. So it would read, the whole phrase would read, to be informed of and to have the opportunity to be present at all criminal or juvenile proceedings where the accused has the right to be present, to have an opportunity to be heard upon request at sentencing and in any proceeding where the accused's release from custody is considered. So the point in that suggestion is to have something less than an absolute right to be there, which still concerns me about the potential implications of that. And I think what is clear would be there would be their opportunity to be there. They don't have a right to be there if it means the state would have to pay to bring them there.
You can still have it. I'm sorry.
Okay. Let's get a response, Representative Parnell.
Well, I would tend to agree with you, and I would tend to support it. I just think you could almost make the same argument, though, that an opportunity requires that we pay somebody's ticket. I don't know that we're getting out of the problem. I mean, it could be right either way. So we could hear the sponsor or perhaps Senator Donnelly on it.
Yeah, I'd like to hear from Representative Navarre, then Senator Donnelly.
Our resident constitutional scholar. Actually, Mr. Chairman, the one thing that putting the opportunity in there would probably allow us to define what a reasonable opportunity is. Whereas right now it seems to say they can be informed and present. It seems an absolute right to be present. And as far as implementing the law, I think that the legislature's authority to implement the law is only for what is not expressly written into the constitutional amendment.
Okay, Senator Donnelly.
I think with Representative Parnell's amendment, you're moving towards the concept of the opportunity of the legislature to define what these rights are. But, you know, the more I've thought about this argument, and maybe Representative Parnell, you can bear with me on this. Let me know if I'm going down the wrong road here. There's a lot of rights that were guaranteed under the Constitution or the Bill of Rights that are the right, basically, the right is that the government doesn't prevent us from doing those things. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion.